Hi, welcome to the show. You know, there's an old saying that begins, sometimes it takes a village. Well, in the case involving Johnny Depp, one of the highest earning actors in Hollywood, who, by the way, has earned a whopping $650 million or so in his career, it actually took a village for him to notice that he was running out of money. He got a phone call from his financial manager telling him he had to sell a small French village he owned in order to stay solvent. I don't understand this. Who owns villages? How do you do that? Anyway, this all became public thanks to a lawsuit Depp filed against his business managers, the brothers Joel and Robert Mandel of TMG. The lawsuit was for mismanagement of funds. Depp claims that throughout his 17-year relationship with TMG, he was kept ignorant about his financial condition, and he accuses TMG of negligence and fraud, and he's asked for $25 million in compensation. Not surprisingly, TMG filed a countersuit against claim for the same amount, plus attorney's fees and commissions owed. As business managers to Depp, TMG served as bookkeeper, accountant, and attorney. In Rob Mandel's own words, they said, they provide services for someone who doesn't want to be bothered with the business side of their life. So a business manager does everything. Pays bills, collects paychecks, and banks them. Makes sure they have the right insurance coverage for everything, the appropriate estate planning products, that their investment portfolio is adequately diversified for their age, degree of risk, and so on. We buy their houses. We buy their cars. We do their tax returns. We help negotiate their contracts. It really runs the gamut from basic everyday services to very complicated life issues. So what really happened to all that money? Turns out Depp, by his own admittance, was a big spender and made a lot of impulse buys. In its defense, TMG lists these extravagances as Depp's lavish residences across the globe, a chain of islands in the Bahamas, and as I said, who owns a chain of islands in the Bahamas? A 150-foot luxury yacht, at least 45 luxury vehicles, $30,000 per month on expensive wines, which I guess explains why I never see him in Total Wine, over 200 works of art, a treasure trove of Hollywood collectibles, 40 full-time employees, $200,000 per month on private jets, and so on. So while Depp made a lot of money, TMG claims that there wasn't a lot left after nearly 50% in federal and state taxes, 10% of his gross earnings paid as fees to his talent agency, 5% to his personal and entertainment lawyer, and TMG's 5% fee, and other professional services. Mortgages on as many properties, plus their upkeep and maintenance, and the $2 million needed every month to fund Depp's ultra-extravagant lifestyle. After warning Depp and his sister repeatedly to rein in spending, things ultimately got to the point that there wasn't enough cash to pay for Depp's various expenses. So, according to the documents filed, TMG urged Depp to reduce his spending and sell some of his unnecessary assets, hence the small French village I referred to at the beginning. When Depp's spending outpaced his earnings, he borrowed large sums of money to support his lifestyle and personally signed for all such loans. Now, whether TMG could have or should have forced him to alter his spending habits remains a contention. Citing TMG's 5% fee, Depp argued that it was TMG's responsibility to keep his finances in order, much as a fee-only financial planner would keep his client's best interests above all else. Depp further claimed that TMG should have terminated its relationship with him if they felt Depp ignored the financial advice of the Mandel brothers, and that they did more harm by not knowing when to end their volatile relationship with Depp. TMG countered that it did everything in its power to professionally and competently handle Depp's business transactions, expenses, and demands, and that ultimately either Depp or his sister, who is also, by the way, his personal manager, decided to spend the money and approve all transactions, and that Depp and Depp alone is fully responsible for any financial turmoil he finds himself in today. The main issue in the lawsuits centers on fiduciary responsibility, you know, which is a word that's becoming more familiar to everyone these days, and it describes putting the client's interests first. Also, plus there was a lack of written management fee contracts, the lack of clearly stated roles and responsibilities, and other fuzzy communications. There were also clear conflicts of interest because Depp's sister, Christy Dombrowski, allegedly received $7 million in loans from Depp's funds, but without Depp's knowledge. So she herself may have wanted to keep Depp in the dark about some of his finances, as a classic case of things getting murky when mixing family relationships with business. And while TMG managed Depp's finances, it also hired and oversaw outside accountants, so there was no separation of the management and the audit functions. In other words, they should have had separate auditors to keep an objective checks and balances on the whole operation. All of this further sullied the waters. So, I think the blame goes around as far as I can see. It was partly Depp's strong personality, reports of excessive drinking, his unwillingness to oversee his own finances, his generosity towards family but without adequate oversight, his sister's deep and complicated involvement with his business and finances, the lack of written agreements, the lack of tight controls on Depp's spending, the lack of financial planning and projections, and waiting till finances really came to a head that led to the current lawsuits. So although Depp is worth a lot of money, there are lessons here for all of us. To help avoid financial fiascos in your life, establish clearly written rules for each party. Understand that you need to have your financial planners separate from your business manager, an independent accountant, an auditor that oversees all your financial dealings. Also, I'd strongly urge you to keep family members away from managing your personal finances, because in the United States, it's wholly possible to have a qualified professional manage your affairs far more effectively than when you confuse lines of authority with your family. And finally, even though you outsource everything, you ultimately must make the time to stay on top of your finances. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Life moves very fast these days. The days zip by, and some things are just pushed aside because, let's face it, they have to be. If it's not in your face and doesn't get your attention right away, all of us will put important things off. Except for some of us, especially when it comes to money, those things reappear when our heads hit the pillow at night. So I want to suggest an idea to you. I've decided to put on another roundtable event where I'm going to help you start focusing on the next stage of your life. I'll show you how to figure out if you'll have enough money to retire, or if you're retired, to figure out if it will be enough to last for the rest of your life. Maybe you want to leave some money behind, and maybe you don't, but how do you really know if the decisions you've made so far are adding up the way they should? And how will you know if the decisions you're making today will be the best for you and your family's future? And here's another thought. Wouldn't it be a shame if you had more than enough money to live the rest of your life the way you wanted to, but you didn't live that way because you were afraid of running out of money? Wouldn't it be a shame if you were holding on to your money too tightly out of fear and uncertainty? I'm going to be tackling these and other important topics at my next roundtable event, which will be at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura on Thursday, June 1st. We'll have two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which time works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. So Thursday, June 1st, at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Join me as we take the time to understand what your money truly means to you so you can get back to sleeping well and knowing that you've figured out how to live your one best financial life. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I know you've all heard of Morningstar, and one of Morningstar's stars is Christine Benz, director of personal finance and author of two books, The 30-Minute Money Solutions, A Step-by-Step Guide to Managing Your Finances, and The Morningstar Guide to Mutual Funds. Hey, Christine, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Today, I want to talk about how much cash for emergencies should a person put aside. You know, some people say 3 months, some people say 6 months. It seems like those answers are a little too simple. How do you look at things?
Yeah, I do think it's important to customize your cash holdings to your own personal situation. I know the old rule of thumb, the one I learned in the Certified Financial Planner program, was 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses. That's what everyone needs. That's a blunt instrument Yeah. Many people need significantly more than that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And it's not quite so simple. It takes a little bit of more complicated thinking. So let's take us through that. The first one you wrote in a recent article was, what is your life stage? What does that mean?
Well, it really depends on whether you're working and still earning an income or whether you're retired. So for people who are still earning an income, maybe employed in some sort of a full-time setting, they may be willing to get, or they may be able to get away with a lower cash cushion, maybe that 3 to 6 months or something in that ballpark is reasonable. For people who are retired, I typically recommend 1 to 2 years worth of true cash instruments. And the basic idea there, the reason as a retiree you'd want to hold more, is that you could encounter a poor stock market or maybe a terrible bond market where we see bond yields shoot up and that hurts bond prices. You don't want to be a seller in those environments. You don't want to have to sell your securities to meet your living expenses. You want to have enough liquid assets on hand to tide you through those weak periods for the market.
So let's talk about that. So as a retiree, I think having 1 to 2 years in cash when cash is like earning next to zero would be problematical. Would you agree to accepting short or intermediate term bonds?
Possibly with a portion of the cash cushion. Mm-hmm. The thing I look at today is that when you're venturing into some sort of a bond product, you have interest rate risk, and yet yields aren't substantially higher than you can earn on a cash account today. So you might be able to find an online savings account that can give you 1%. Mm-hmm. Well, even a high quality short-term bond fund might be at 1.5%. Right. So you kind of have to weigh, am I willing to take the interest rate risk there, the risk of having a little bit of a loss relative to my ability to pick up a little bit more yield?
Yeah, and you're talking about a double whammy. You're talking about not only the stock market going down, you don't want to draw from your stock portfolio while it's down. And then you think, well, I've got my bonds, but you're thinking also, well, if we have this rapid rise in interest rates, then bond prices are going to go down. So this, you know, relatively low probability of both happening. It has happened. It doesn't happen very often, but that's what the cash would be for that probability of both markets being down.
Right, right. Okay. Because as I said, you just don't want to be a seller in such an environment. But diversification is the name of the game. You want to have bonds, you want to have stocks, you want to have cash, because the probability of everything being down at any given point in time is really low, especially cash, obviously.
Okay, so we talked about life stages. The second question you want to ask yourself is, how stable is your income?
Right. Yeah, it's a really important consideration today because you've got so many people who are participating in the gig economy in some way. Mm-hmm. I've got more and more friends who have taken on work as contractors, and it can be really lucrative while they're working. The crucial point to make, though, is that they might sometimes have significant disruptions in their income where they might go without a job for 3 months or so.
Yeah.
So if you are someone whose income tends to be lumpy for whatever reason, it's crucial to have enough cash set aside.
Absolutely.
So that you're not having to invade your retirement assets or your other long-term assets just to meet your living expenses.
Yeah, you know, this is something that's very important. It's a little bit off topic, but something that I've thought about that many people do not talk about. And the fact is that when you have your long-term investment assets like your 401k, and you have a job that's not necessarily stable, let's say it's in a cyclical industry, the worst thing that can happen to you is that you lose your job, and at the same time, the stock market is down because the economy is weak. Perhaps that's the reason you've lost your job. And now you have to dip into your 401k at the worst possible time when stocks are depressed. And, you know, it's a double whammy. So that's why if you have a cyclical type of job or you work in a cyclical industry, it's really good to have more cash outstanding than I think a person in a more stable industry.
That's such a good point. The investment philosopher, writer Bill Bernstein has called the definition of risk bad returns in bad times, right?
Yeah.
That's why you hold cash to help ensure that you're not losing your job in a bad market and then having to sell stuff, sell securities in that weak market as well.
My guest is Christine Benz. She is a director of personal finance at Morningstar. Christine, so here's another one. Are you the sole earner in your household? Why is that important?
Well, it's important because if you are part of a dual income family, that means that you have at least one other income still coming in the door. It's very unlikely that you would both lose your jobs at the same time. So it does provide a little bit more buffer than the person who's the sole earner. If you are the main person earning a salary in your household, I think that argues for having a larger cash cushion than the person who's part of the dual income family.
Yeah, the chances of both of you losing jobs is a much lower probability than just one person, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Question here, can you access cash in other ways? When we talk about cash, we discussed this a little bit before, but what are we talking about? What is cash to the average person?
Well, cash is your checking and savings account. You might have CDs, money market accounts, online savings accounts. Those are true cash instruments. You mentioned short-term bonds. If you had some sort of a high-quality short-term bond fund, mm-hmm. that might be next line reserves in case your cash cushion were depleted. And then you might think of additional sources of funds if you absolutely needed them. So a lot of people hold a home equity line of credit for this very reason.
Right.
That in case they lose their jobs, they'd rather have that HELOC available to them than have to apply for it when they don't have a job and are unlikely to have that line of credit extended. So HELOC would be one idea. Another thing I often tell young people to think about is start a Roth IRA, because while you don't want to have to rate it and you want to leave the money to grow for your retirement, worst case scenario, you can withdraw your contributions at any time and for any reason.
Yeah.
So that's another potential source of funds.
I think the key word, and this is a word that I want everybody to know and to learn, is liquidity, the ability to turn something into cash immediately. That's why a checking account, a savings account are highly liquid. I guess even to a certain extent, a long-term CD, even though there may be a penalty associated with turning it in, it's still liquid and you'll still get your money back. You'll just get a little bit less interest. And this would be different than your home, for example, which is incredibly highly illiquid if liquidity is defined as the ability to turn money into cash on a moment's notice. What about keeping cash aside for the opportunistic investor? I know that I was just at the Berkshire annual shareholder meeting and Warren Buffett was up there and he was saying, you know, he's got $95 billion in cash waiting for opportunities. I think the rest of us have a significantly less amount. But what about this idea about leaving cash aside for investment opportunities?
I think that it's a perfectly reasonable idea. Certainly when we look across the best investment managers, in addition to Warren Buffett, that's one commonality that I see among many of them is that many of them are willing to say, you know what, I think that the markets, I'm just not finding a lot to buy in today's market. I'm going to wait until other people are selling, and that's when I'll dive in. So I think for individual investors, especially now, given that we have had this tremendous ascent in the U.S. market, investors who perhaps want to keep a little extra aside and know that they will deploy that money into the stock market if it takes a dip, I think that's a perfectly reasonable strategy. In fact, I like the idea of also compiling a watch list.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're an individual stock investor or someone who invests in funds, that you might say, I really like the way that this manager manages assets. I just don't want to commit additional assets to the U.S. market right now. Go ahead and compile that watch list. In addition to having your cash ready, you also have some ideas ready.
Good advice from Christine Benz, Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Thanks so much for joining us, Christine.
Thank you, Steve. Always a pleasure.
To hear this interview again and to join the conversation, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. Do you have enough money to live the life you want to live? Do you have the resources to support you and your loved ones? And how do you know if you'll have enough to retire, or if you retired, how would you know if it will be enough to last the rest of your life? Well, that's exactly what my next roundtable event is going to be about. I'm going to answer these and other questions on Thursday, June 1st. I've even set up two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's Thursday, June 1st at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which one works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. With graduation season upon us, I thought we'd focus on students and their money. Let's meet Jill Gonzalez, consumer finance expert and financial literacy advocate, also an analyst for WalletHub. You know, building excellent credit is the best way to minimize the cost of student debt while paying off your balances as quickly as possible. I want to talk to Jill about some of the best credit cards available. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So there was an article written, 2017's best cards for recent grads. So why don't you take us through that?
So finding credit cards for recent graduates could be a little bit troublesome depending on your situation. So one, you might have good credit. This might be a new card for you. You might have been authorized on your parents' card. So you have some type of credit file. You might have had loans in your name. So a credit file to build on, that's where we can get some really better credit cards here. Capital One Quicksilver Cash Rewards is a good one. Chase Slate, Citi Double Cash Card, all have really great offers right now. Around average APR rates, but really good rewards, mostly in the form of cash back anywhere from 1% to 2%.
I know that one of the cash back cards I'm very familiar with requires that you pay your balances every month.
Absolutely. And that's how you get that double cash back feature. Mm-hmm. So the Citi card, I think, you know, I'm a huge proponent for because I think it really teaches people and motivates people to be paying up at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So that card gives 1% cash back across all purchases and another percent cash back when you pay your monthly bill.
You know, it's a big shock. I have that card and I was late, or no, I didn't pay back the full balance 1 month. So I thought, well, let's just say it was $1,000 outstanding. I paid back $500. I thought they were going to only charge me on the $500. They charged me interest on the whole beeswax. I did not get my extra 1%, and I got stung with a lot of interest. So you really have to commit to paying this card off every single month if you want to keep that benefit.
Right. And you don't have to necessarily be paying it every single month if you can't. But again, it does give a huge overall earning rate if you do.
Yeah.
And that's a good point that you brought up. I think a lot of recent grads who might not be familiar with credit might think, this is when I'm charged my interest, right? At the end of the month.
Right.
No, it's compounded daily.
Yeah.
So that's a good lesson to learn. And you learned it the hard way.
I did. I learned it the hard way. But, you know, I learned from my mistakes. So I'll never do that again. Now, there are cards that are better for grads that have limited credit. Tell us about those.
So a lot of grads have no credit file coming out of college. They maybe were not an authorized user on the parents' cards. They didn't have a card of their own. Maybe they were lucky enough to not have student loans. So there's nothing there. That's what's known as a thin file in the credit industry. Mm. And there are cards that really do help with students. If you still have your .edu email available to you, these are good cards to definitely get into. The Bank AmeriCard Travel Rewards for Students, the Journey Student Rewards card from Capital One, and another Bank AmeriCard, the Cash Rewards for Students. So all of these will be a little bit easier to get approved for. And I think that's what grads have a tough time doing. I think a lot of them think, hey, I can apply for cards and I'll get one. Sometimes they apply for anywhere from one to up to 10 cards we've seen. And having 10 hard inquiries on your credit report is not ideal.
That's going to hurt.
Those things,
yeah,
exactly. They stick around for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of graduates don't know that. So it's better to just go ahead and apply for a card that you have good approval odds for.
So how do they account for those with limited credit? I mean, the interest rates are higher. I mean, somehow the credit card company has got to compensate itself for the extra risk.
Exactly. The interest rates are a little bit higher, I would say in the 20 to 24%
wow.
range, as opposed to the average is around 14%.
Wow.
But the good thing here is that A, it's not a secured card, which would need you to put a deposit down.
Yeah, that is good.
And two, there's still rewards. So a lot of these cards that are easy to get approved for are just a line of credit. They don't really come with anything, but these do have rewards in the form of miles, mm-hmm. in the form of cash back, up to 1.25%. So those are definite pluses.
Gotcha. What about a grad that does not have a .edu email? What's available for them?
That's when you would probably have to go the secured route. There is one other card that you could try, which is the Capital One Platinum Credit Card. It's entirely unsecured, so that's a good thing. No deposit here. There's no rewards, which is not ideal. But the good thing about this card is that after about a year or so of on-time payments, a good track record, no maxing it out, they actually upgrade you to a Capital One card with rewards.
So it's a good starter card. But again, in all these situations, you have to be diligent and you have to really be smart about it, because on that one card, for you to pay a minimum balance and to be paying 24% on the remaining balance, I mean, why bother looking for anything on sale if you're going to end up paying 24% more for it at the end of the year? Just think about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why, you know, obviously starting with a credit card is your first step here, but then maintaining it, making sure you're on track. We always say just enroll in autopay the second you get the card, because that really does cut down on a lot of forgetfulness.
Yeah. And make sure that you have the kind of income that's steady income and that you're sure that you can, you know, support it. You're not going to go a month or two without any income or minimal income. And then, you know, it's a question between, you know, eating and paying off your credit card. You know, that's a bad thing. Or paying the minimum on your credit card. That's not good either. So be smart about that. WalletHub also did a study you were involved with that looked at student loan borrowers, the rate of delinquency, and it was released in a 2017 report. Also, the report was the cities with the most and least student debt. Tell us a little bit about that.
In this report, we looked at which cities were the most over-leveraged on student debt. And what that really focuses in on is the student debt to income ratio within these cities. A real surprise here that many over-leveraged cities also happen to be college towns. Places like Bloomington, Indiana, Athens, Georgia, College Park, Georgia as well. So a lot of these are near the top here. And that's because there's a lot of debt there, obviously student loans, and very little full-time employment, especially where the students are concerned. There might be some part-time earnings, but obviously not enough to really be taking on this debt. Right now, the average student debt is getting up there. It's around $25,000 in most of these cities, some more like $40,000, others none at all. So some near the bottom of the rankings are more affluent suburbs, right, where the population is a little bit older, more years under their work experience, growing incomes, and they're able to pay off that debt.
On the site, there is a student loan calculator to determine a payment amount, a realistic payment amount based on your income, and also, more importantly, probably a realistic payoff timeline, because really you don't want to be paying such a low payment that you're paying it for the next 30 years. That's going to get in the way a lot of your plans.
Absolutely. And this is pretty straightforward. You enter your loan amount, the loan term in years, and the interest rate, and it spits out a monthly payment and also gives you when that loan will be paid off.
While we're talking about finances, what are some money-saving tips that you can offer recent college grads? How can they get off on the right foot?
I think grads that are new to a job, new to kind of living on their own, new to spending money on their own that's actually theirs, I think a lot of things might be new to them. So one thing here is to really look into saving and investing. And I think that's an easy blanket statement to say, you know, save up.
It's not easy.
But there should,
yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think it's a little bit more doable when you have clear goals.
Okay.
So if you set yourself up to set aside at least 10% of your monthly take-home pay, by the end of the year, you've got a nice little rainy day fund that is nice to have if anything happens with your job, if there's an emergency. That's a really good thing to be able to fall back on.
Very good point. My guest, Jill Gonzalez, consumer financial expert and financial literacy advocate, and also analyst at WalletHub.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Jill.
Anytime.
And remember to join this conversation and to hear this interview again, go to SteVePomerantz.com. Terry Story and Real Estate Roundup is next.
Little boxes on the inside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the inside, little boxes all the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, and today we're going to talk about Vero Beach. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So Vero Beach is a town that's, you know, about an hour or so north of South Florida. Tell me a little bit about what you know about it.
Sure. It's actually a really nice community. I've been up there. It's more seasonal. There's lots of restaurants. It's a quieter community than what we have here down in South Florida. They've got, you know, an active Coast Guard community. And so you'll find a lot of like naval retirees retreat there.
Okay.
Anywhere you live there, Steve, you're like 15 to 20 minutes away from the beach. So as a matter of fact, we get a lot of people from, say, the Stewart area, Fort Lauderdale area, that go up there as a retreat to get away from the hustle bustle of our areas.
Yeah, I mean, things are getting very crowded in South Florida. And, you know, to do anything is a bit of a challenge and a fight to get there, to park, to pay. But Vero Beach is very much a quieter, a little bit more sleepy community. It's easy to get access to the beach with free parking. It's a beautiful area. They have a wide lagoon, so to speak, there in the intercoastal, right?
Yeah, it's the Indian River. That they call it the lagoon, but it's actually what we would call the intercoastal. It's the Indian River.
What's the median price for a home up there?
You know, the median price is about $188,000, which comes out to about $132 a square foot.
That's pretty low.
Yeah. The range, they have a lot of single family homes, 250 to 350 range. They've got new construction going on right now, which they haven't seen in a while. And their markets like ours, they're not seeing the short sales or foreclosures anymore.
Yeah. What about growth? Has the median price been growing?
Absolutely. Everything has been growing everywhere in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the trends are they've been going up about 10% year over year, which is, you know, to give
that's
you an example.
Good.
Yeah, it's really good.
But if the median house is around 188, so they must have been significantly lower before. But there is a high-end, a well-known high-end community up in Vero Beach as well on John Island, right?
That's right. Yeah, you're looking at, you know, multi-million dollar homes. They also have, Steve, a private golf course community. It's a community where it's invitation only. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know it exists up there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're into golfing and want a nice community, there's that as well.
So the real estate market is pretty hot in most areas. We were talking about that earlier weeks. So people are flipping properties, but sometimes flipping can be a little challenging on a legal basis. Tell us about that.
That's right. You know, what's important about flipping properties is to recognize or know who the seller really is. For example, banks, REO sales. In some cases, the bank hasn't yet legally acquired the property. It's in foreclosure. So what happens is sometimes the bank will put the home up for sale, secure a buyer, yet they don't even have legal title to the property. So really what's important about this is recognizing that there is sometimes when a property is being flipped, who is the rightful owner. You'll also see stuff like this, Steve, when somebody has passed away and there's an heir to the property. It's a good idea to find out, do they have title to the property at that point? Another real common problem that we see when a property is flipped, if an investor purchased the home, they haven't owned it for a certain amount of time yet, you may be required to obtain two appraisals, you know, as a purchaser.
Mm.
So you just need to understand and know who the seller is and recognize that there may be some issues if this property has been flipped.
I remember in the last bull real estate market, you know, in 05 and so on, that people were buying homes and they weren't even closing them. They were selling them before they closed them. You know, it's kind of like they were buying like an option on the house.
Right.
You know, technically. But I mean, have you seen any of that these days?
No, I haven't seen any of that. I do remember seeing it. And really, the thing that I saw most really had to do with an investor fixing it and having to wait so many days before they could sell it to somebody getting a loan.
Oh, yeah.
That seemed to be the number one thing that I don't remember what it was, maybe 120 days. I don't remember exactly what it was, but you had to wait, especially with like a FHA, VA finance involved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't allow it to be flipped like that.
Yeah, one caveat here, you know, the idea of flipping homes seems really kind of exciting and easy to do. It's a lot better than working, you know?
Yeah, when it works out for you.
Well, yes, but remember that like anything, you know, if it comes easy, it's probably not going to succeed in your life. So you have to treat it like a business. You have to look at the legal aspects of thing, the actual cost of getting the property, you know, up to speed. You have to understand the market. You really, really, really have to treat it like a serious business, not as something that, you know, you can just do so easily with the promise of, you know, getting rich quick. So let's
Absolutely.
Remember that. Yeah.
And they take a lot of shortcuts, Steve. An investor will go in and start, you know, fixing a house. And then one project leads to another project and they run out of their budget.
Wow.
So you'll see so many shortcuts with these investors.
Yeah. They throw some paint on it, you know, some paneling.
Yeah, they yeah. open up a can of worms and then they don't finish their job. They just close up that hole. Just be aware.
Be careful out there. All right, let's talk about renters here. I think this is important. This is a question that many people have. When you go out renting and you see that they want you to put some money down and they call it a fee or they call it a deposit, what is the difference between the two?
I think what's confusing is they have what they call a non-refundable deposit. Really, that is a fee, mm-hmm. if you think about it. And where you see this most often, Steve, is with pets. Some landlords will say, I will allow you to have a pet, but there is going to be a non-refundable deposit, which really they should just call it, here's a pet fee.
Yeah.
Which as a fee, that means you're not getting the money back. It's what a fee is. It's mm-hmm. cost mm-hmm. to have the pet versus a refundable deposit. And when it comes to pet, you know, pets in itself, it could be a charge, a fee, or it can be a refundable deposit, depending if, you know, if there's no damage to the property, you'll generally get your money back. So that's the main
difference. That pet fee doesn't sound right. That non-refundable deposit doesn't sound right. I mean, if you got a deposit and there's damage, that's what the deposit's for. I think a non-refundable deposit is exactly that. It's a fee. It's an extra cost.
Right. They just don't want to call it a fee.
They don't. Well, I think I know why, because they know it's just adding to the guy's profit. And, you know, is it really fair? I wonder about that.
Yeah, it depends.
It depends. Everything depends. All right. So now here's a question. Do investors, let's say you want to go out and buy a property and start to rent it out, do you need landlord insurance? This is new.
Yeah, this is something that I never really was aware of. Apparently, there's an add-on that you can get called landlord insurance. And landlord insurance covers a variety of stuff, but in general, it will protect the house, apartment, or condo, whatever it is, against covered perils. So for example, if there's severe weather, natural disasters, vandalism, it might also cover the owner if someone is injured at the property, like if a tenant trips. Mm-hmm. Some landlord insurance policy also provide what they call income coverage protection. So for example, if the property becomes unlivable due to an event like a fire, the landlord would have to pay a fair market value for rent while that house is being repaired.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and then some other policies offer rent default covered. You know, if the tenant doesn't pay, the landlord would be able to receive out-of-pocket money in assistance with legal fees.
Yeah, well, that sounds expensive.
Yeah, so from what I understand, this landlord insurance is about 25% more than a homeowner's insurance policy.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
I mean, it's like anything else, Steve. It's insurance.
You know, last year we went to Boulder to visit some relatives, and we stayed in an Airbnb. And the day before, there were three apartments, and two of them burnt. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and ours kind of smelled, but they got it all fixed up, and we were fine. But, you know, I guess the landlord, you know, she lost all of the rent from that. So the landlord insurance would have kicked in by then.
Yeah. I mean, I want to look into this because I really don't know anything about this specific little policy.
Okay.
And I guess it varies from location to location as to how expensive it is.
Well, insurance, you know, you hope you never need it, but sometimes you got to get it because you want to protect the rest of your assets and your income and so on. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Do you have enough money to live the life you want to live? Do you have the resources to support you and your loved ones? And how do you know if you'll have enough to retire, or if you retired, how would you know if it will be enough to last the rest of your life? Well, that's exactly what my next roundtable event is going to be about. I'm going to answer these and other questions on Thursday, June 1st. I've even set up two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's Thursday, June 1st at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which one works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. The statistics say that about 50% of married couples end up in divorce. Well, that surely is old news. We've heard that before. But the experience afterward is something rarely discussed in financial circles, especially with regard to the impact on women. My next guest discusses it and writes about it all the time in a very intelligent manner. Stacey Freeman is a writer, blogger, a divorced single mom, entrepreneur, and a person that knows how to ask and answer the right questions. She's currently the lifestyle editor for Worthy.com, has been connecting with divorced moms across the country through the Worthy Living blog. I'd like to welcome her to the show. Hey, Stacey, welcome.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Let's start on a positive note. You know, WorthyLiving.com or Worthy.com just had a recent study that showed that women are actually pretty savvy when it comes to money. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, at Worthy, we conducted this survey, and what we found was women actually answered that they didn't feel confident about how they handled money. But once the results were analyzed, it turns out that women actually do know more than they thought.
Yeah. I'm a financial planner, and I see that a lot. I think a lot of people come in thinking they don't really know that much, but maybe the statistics tell a different story that's very, very interesting. So they know, in general, based on this, they know a lot, but I think a lot of them find themselves overwhelmed, and there's an emotional impact to the questions about surrounding money. Give us some examples of that.
Well, I know from my personal experience, during my marriage, I handled our finances pretty much within about 6 months of getting married. I got married very young. I was still in school, and my then husband had gone out to work, and he literally could not get to paying the bills. He wasn't home. So I took on that job in our household and began managing our personal finances. I analyzed them to the umpteenth degree all throughout our marriage. I had spreadsheets, really analyzed our budget. And then I was suddenly divorced, suddenly separated when I turned 39, and I couldn't focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was focusing on everything else besides that.
Sure.
The divorce process, my children.
Yeah.
And I let things kind of, you know, fall by the wayside. I wasn't opening the mail. You know, I like to say the squeaky wheel was getting the grease. So whoever was asking me for money was the one who got paid. And that's really not the way to handle your finances.
Yeah, so you're overwhelmed during that period. There's a lot going on, especially emotionally. But, you know, you did have a little bit of a head start in the fact that you were actually crunching the numbers, you know, while you were married. So you had a pretty good idea of what you guys were spending. So when you came to the divorce proceedings, that was pretty easy for you, right?
Yeah, I actually had it all set up because I had analyzed our household budget using an Excel spreadsheet and knew pretty much where every dollar was going.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have a head start preparing that case information statement for my divorce.
One of the blogs that you wrote was about the budget challenges that divorced women now face themselves, especially if there's children involved. What are some tips that you wrote about that you can offer or solutions that you discovered in order to get your budget in order?
Well, you know, once I got separated, I had to start living on, I hate to say a fixed income, but, you know, I had a set amount of money each month, and it, you know, it had to be distributed to clothing, to household expenses. And I really had to make sure that there was enough money to pay for each of these areas of my life. So I had to look and see, you know, where I needed to cut back, and I couldn't live the same lifestyle that I had been living. So some of the things that I looked at, which I figured, you know, I can live without, was going out to eat as many times during the week as we had when I was married. I started making my coffee at home, saving myself over $1,600 a year.
Wow.
One of the first things I did was cancel my gym membership because all I felt I needed was a few weights, a pair of sneakers, and I was good to go.
Okay.
I started buying cheaper makeup, just because I had gotten tips from people along, you know, through the years. I didn't need to spend $30 on a mascara. It wasn't necessary. And who would know what I was wearing anyway?
Mm-hmm.
I stopped going to big box stores. I just started watching sales at the supermarket and stocking up when things were on sale. And then, of course, I started looking around my house for things that I didn't need anymore or didn't want anymore, like clothing, shoes. People have sold diamond jewelry.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that, you know, you're not wearing your engagement ring anymore. It's sitting in a drawer. Right. And yes, there may be some sentimental attachment to it, but as time passes, you know, you might want to repurpose it and use that money for something that will further your future.
Yeah, you know, we all, if you think about it, we all live on fixed income. I mean, unless somehow we're just, you know, infinitely wealthy, but every single one of us lives on a fixed income. So these ideas are really do relate. We can all relate to them across all of our lifestyles. I think the key here, though, is that, you know, you had a lifestyle with maybe two incomes. Now you're a lifestyle with one income. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about how you manage this idea that you're setting priorities for your daily living, taking care of your children. And yet, in the meantime, you have to think about, well, how is college going to get paid? How am I going to set aside a retirement income? What thought processes did you go through for that?
Well, to correct you on one point,
sure.
I did not work outside the home during my marriage.
Okay.
So that was one of the challenges that I faced mm-hmm. after becoming separated. So I really had to focus on, A, how to manage my money that I had coming in from spousal support, and then I had to supplement it. So
you had to go out and find something
I did
to earn a living. I want to talk about that in a minute. You know, there was one thing that you wrote in one of your blogs that caught my attention. It says, you have to decide, you're sitting there, you have a limited budget, decide between yoga lessons, credit card payments, and a dress wanted by your daughter. How do you handle that kind of situation?
Okay, so this is real life. So yeah. You really, that bill is sitting in front of you, but then so is your child. And it's very difficult to tell a kid, you know, hey, you can't have this because we don't have the money because we're now, you know, divorced, your parents aren't married, and there's a limited amount of money. It's very difficult, you know, in real life to turn to your child and say, you can't have this. So you have to look at the big picture. Where can I get this money from with what I have? So, you know, a great way is to sell things around your house. I don't need this anymore. I don't need my engagement ring. I'm not wearing it. I don't need that expensive pair of shoes. That bag is out of style. So get rid of that, cut from certain areas, and then lo and behold, the money appears. And then you can use it for something that's more pressing or something that you want and will enjoy.
Yeah, an interesting answer. So getting back to this idea that you're now handling the present, you know, it's not easy from what you're describing to make these changes. Some of them must be pretty gut-wrenching. But you're also thinking about college in the future and your own retirement. How did you handle that?
So I analyzed with my financial advisor what I had and what I still needed. So I have set up smaller funds and, you know, targeted those areas that I need to supplement. And just as I cut from certain areas, I now have redistributed into the areas that are still lacking.
Mm-hmm. So college fund, you set up a 529 or something?
Well, we had set up 529s when each child was born mm-hmm. and had put in a little bit here and there as well as saving regularly. So, you know, even if your child is 15 and you think, oh my God, I'm only 3 years away, what can I do now? The money adds up quickly. So even if you're putting in that birthday present from the grandparents or, you know, money that they got for a religious event or whatever, it adds up quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
You can't look at it like, well, I didn't do this in the past. You know, you have to look forward.
Yeah, there is a snowball effect. I tell people who haven't saved and they start saving, and I said 1,000 becomes 5 before you know it, becomes 10. I mean, you just keep doing it. You keep at it. It's amazing how fast this can accumulate. Just like debt on the bad side of things, debt can accumulate really fast too, but so can savings. So, you know, don't ever forget that. I think that's a very good lesson. My guest is Stacey Freeman, writer, blogger, divorced single mom, entrepreneur, and the lifestyle editor for Worthy.com, and she has her Worthy Living blog. So you did something that I thought was pretty unusual, Stacy. When you decided to go back to work, you just didn't look for any job. You decided to pursue life's passion, which I thought was pretty risky and pretty brave. Tell us about that.
You know, I had to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And obviously, divorce is a big life change. And my overarching goal was to be happy. And I loved writing always, even as a young child. And that is what I wanted to do. And I had to figure out how to monetize it. So I had sat down and started a blog, got my name out there, and developed a business plan. And within a few years, I now have a growing business. And once my children are out of the house, something I can continue to grow as the years go by. You know, I have something for now and for my future.
You must have run into some obstacles. You know, the social media world is populated by a lot of younger people. So I think you probably went in thinking, well, you know, am I going to be able to compete against, you know, those who were brought up with this social media and, you know, blogging and the like? So I think you said to yourself, you're not getting any younger. What did you do about that?
I kind of looked at what I had done in the past. And I think that many stay-at-home moms don't realize how much they have done. And if you just take a step back and look, you've been managing your household budget. You've been running events at your children's school. You've been doing a lot. And those skills can be transitioned into your work life. So I think it's just first you have to look back and say, okay, what have I done? What am I good at? And how am I going to now utilize this in my new life?
Not all work experience happens in an office, I think.
Not at all.
Right.
Not at all.
So, you know, you talked about monetizing this blog. There's a lot of people with blogs who wonder how to monetize it. How do you get money for something like this? What were some of the first steps you took to start getting some income from your blog?
I never really monetized the actual blog. I used it to promote my own brand.
Oh.
So I used it as a way to showcase my skills, and then I went from there. But I never actually, there are people who do make money from the blog itself through advertising and other means, but that was not my plan.
So you hooked up with an established site, and as I introduced earlier, Worthy.com. Is that what you're talking about?
A few years ago, I did start my own blog. This is actually the byproduct of the work that I have done over the past few years. So once I was able to write and get myself published on larger platforms, not just my blog, but on more national platforms, my name got out there. And Worthy came to me and said, hey, you know, we've been reading some of your things, some of your articles, and will you come and write for us and continue the message that you've been putting out there for divorced women and telling your story?
Oh, that must have been pretty exciting.
It was so exciting, and yeah. It's very gratifying to know that the work I have done, first of all, is helping other people, and that I'm being recognized for it. So you really, if you set your mind to anything and you're doing what you love, what your passion is, really the sky is the limit.
You know, we're getting back to this idea about women entering the workforce later. I mean, you're wiser because you have all these years' experience behind you. You're bolder because you failed and succeeded so many times before. You knew what some of the risks are. Now, being young has certain advantages because when you're young, you don't know that you can't do things. And
right.
A lot of those things turn out to be successful because everybody thought, oh, you can't do that, but you're young, you didn't know any better. But, you know, being older and having more experience helps you to also focus your time, not make so many mistakes.
I've made plenty of mistakes. I think the key is to, you know, look at the mistake, you know, realize, you know, what can I learn from it, and just not let it get you down. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've made plenty of mistakes. That's how you learn. That's how you figure out what you're good at and what you're not.
Absolutely. A personal look at the life of Stacy Freeman and how she basically came out of divorce and established a new life for herself, got her budget under control, and then writes about it quite frequently at Worthy.com, and it's her Worthy Living blog. Stacy Freeman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was so nice to be here.
To find out more about Stacey Freeman and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Life moves very fast these days. The days zip by, and some things are just pushed aside, because let's face it, they have to be. If it's not in your face and doesn't get your attention right away, all of us will put important things off. Except for some of us, especially when it comes to money, those things reappear when our heads hit the pillow at night. So I want to suggest an idea to you. I've decided to put on another roundtable event where I'm going to help you start focusing on the next stage of your life. I'll show you how to figure out if you'll have enough money to retire, or if you're retired, to figure out if it will be enough to last for the rest of your life. Maybe you want to leave some money behind, and maybe you don't. But how do you really know if the decisions you've made so far are adding up the way they should? And how will you know if the decisions you're making today will be the best for you and your family's future? And here's another thought. Wouldn't it be a shame if you had more than enough money to live the rest of your life the way you wanted to, but you didn't live that way because you were afraid of running out of money? Wouldn't it be a shame if you were holding on to your money too tightly out of fear and uncertainty? I'm going to be tackling these and other important topics at my next roundtable event, which will be at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura on Thursday, June 1st. We'll have two separate times for your convenience, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com and choose which time works best for you. That's stevepomerantz.com. So Thursday, June 1st, at the Aquilina Resort in Aventura at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Join me as we take the time to understand what your money truly means to you so you can get back to sleeping well and knowing that you've figured out how to live your one best financial life. Sign up at stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.